Hello, and welcome to episode 78 of the Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming podcast. It's the 3rd of February, I'm Tom Francis, and with me here today are...
Hello, Graham Smith.
It's our... Hello, what are you guys? And...
Hi, Chris Thurston.
Damn, I ruined that. So quickly, too.
Yeah.
You can make up for it by telling us what you've been playing.
I've been playing Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes.
Is that Metal Gear Solid 5? Ground Zeroes.
Yes, Metal Gear Solid V Ground Zeroes.
Oh, it's really significant that it's a V, apparently, I read on the internet.
I have not discovered that significance yet, but I'm not fully up on Kojima.
There's probably a character called V.
Neither am I.
Probably.
But it's because every other Metal Gear numbered game has had a numeral, not a Roman numeral, so therefore he's up to something. And to be fair, if there was ever a game developer that would be up to something with something that innocuous, then it would be Hideo Kojima.
I've been, picking up little bits of the lore as I've been playing it, and you play as Big Boss, who was previously a member of a paramilitary group called Fox, and then he left and founded a group called Foxhound, and then he left and formed another group, and now he's just discovered that there is now a new group called XOF, Fox spelled backwards. And they seem to be led by a man who I think is called Skullface, whose face has been badly burned, so he looks sort of like that Captain America villain, the Red Skull, but without the colour red. So just Skullface. But other than the batshitness, which I'm quite enjoying for its own sake, it's fucking great. Have you guys played it?
No, I've seen a video in which a man, I think, maybe plants a debt pack or something on a tower, or maybe just puts an explosive barrel there, and then waits for a guard patrolling the grounds beneath it to walk past, and then shoots the barrel, or triggers a debt pack or whatever, blows up the tower, and the guy in the tower flies out of it in such a way that his body lands on the other patrolling guard and kills him. Which definitely sold me on the game.
That's completely atypical compared to my experiences in it so far, which have been mostly about crawling around in the dark and rain and being spotted by a man I didn't see somewhere across a muddy courtyard.
Sounds great!
It's a proper stealth game in the way that, say, Far Cry 4 is not at all a proper stealth game, even if you're trying to sneak your way through it. Because Far Cry 4 always, even if you're trying to play it in a very particular way, feels like a sandbox or a toy box. It feels like you're very powerful. You're much more powerful than the people you're hunting. Mm-hmm. And the way you stealth your way through it is just kill all the men until there are no men. But you're trying to do it without being seen. Because Metal Gear Solid is weirdly, I guess, more realistic despite Skullface and all his glory at the start and all the other weird stuff that's going on. But it's a game that you should definitely play, Tom, because it's a single base that you can approach in dozens of different ways, and it's all uniform rules for the way it works, and it's kind of systemic, and you've got a couple of objectives that you're trying to do that you can approach in lots of different ways. And it's lots of different ways, not in terms of your tool set necessarily, but in terms of the routes around that base and how you maneuver around it. And so I know we've talked about it on the pod a little bit before, but I think we only talked about it when it was about to come out, or when we knew it was coming out, rather than afterwards. But there's stuff like there's vehicles in the base that are just driving around and parking, or sometimes a guard will just walk over and get into a truck and drive off, and you can climb into the back of it and hide. And that's an easy way to make huge progress over an area that would otherwise be incredibly difficult to get through. But you can similarly yourself just get in the truck and drive around. And even though guards see you, they don't necessarily assume that this truck driving around at night has a bad man inside it.
Yeah.
They don't have any way of knowing. And so you get these situations where you get spotted slightly and there's a guard coming over to investigate, and you can just round back around a corner, climb inside a truck and drive off and drive past the man who's coming over to look at you. You don't necessarily assume that that truck contains the bad man that he thinks maybe he just saw. But the guards typically are much smarter than guards in these games tend to be. Like, in Far Cry, it can be glorious sunshine, but the guards can't see 15 feet in front of themselves. And if you're standing sort of near a bush, then that counts as cover. Whereas this is at night, and you can round a corner, and a man who's 50 feet away will spot you if he's looking in your direction at that time. And that means that everything is just really tense all the time. And it's super satisfying to plot routes through this really carefully woven environment. It's just great.
If you get in a car and then you drive towards a guard, have you tried that? Have you tried continuing to drive towards him until the point that you run him over? I'm interested in what the threshold is as to when they realise that it's not...
There are points friend. Where they become suspicious of the truck, and there's a little reading that comes up on their HUD to let you know that. If you drive towards them, they will sort of go, whoa, and dive out of the way, but that won't necessarily flip them hostile.
Crazy Jake after his old antics.
But if you do run them over, then everyone becomes hostile at that point. And pretty much any time, like, it doesn't fail the mission or anything like that. As far as I can tell, you can keep playing, and you're fairly resilient, or at least the guards are a poor enough shot, that when you trigger everyone and everyone goes nuts and the alarm starts flaring and everyone starts firing at you, you can play it like an action game and kill them. I think you would probably struggle to complete any of the objectives unless you killed everyone, because the objectives, for example, are all about exfiltration, or the initial objectives anyway. It's about finding people, carrying them over your shoulder, which limits your moveset, and getting them to a point where you can radio a helicopter, and then the helicopter takes maybe 60 seconds to arrive and for you to put them on and that sort of thing. And so I think that would be extremely difficult where you were getting shot at. But I like, first of all, that it's a game which doesn't... It's not a fail state, necessarily, to get spotted by the guards, but at the same time, it's a proper punishment. Which, again, there's so few stealth games that do that. And even, like, I played... I think it was called Styx, Master of Shadows, which was sort of a proper stealth game, in that it was following Thief in a lot of ways, but it was still based in magic. And so the way in which it telegraphed routes through that world were all through use your magic spidey sense to see guards and to highlight things and that sort of stuff. Whereas Metal Gear Solid, you can tag enemies on your HUD using your binoculars, but doesn't have anything where you go into Big Boss vision and, and now you can see footprints in the ground that lead you to the handholds of a wall path or something that's going to just take you past everything. It feels much more sort of dynamic for that. And every time I've played it, and I die a lot, so I've kind of gone through the mission and I've completed it now, but I've kind of gone through it 15, 20 times through the process of completing it. And every time I've taken a different route and found completely different areas and had completely different experiences, and guards have been in different areas. And then once you do complete that objective the first time, you get a new set of objectives and you can play the map during the day, and it's got, you know, different considerations to take into account.
When the enemies do detect you, is there any way to get back to the kind of stealth state?
Yeah, so they've got kind of multiple alert states. If you get detected by just one guard and there's no other guard around, then you can kill him, and probably someone will have heard and they'll be coming to investigate, but you can run off and you can hide and everything will calm down eventually. You also, when you first get, like, there's a suspicion meter that comes up and says, oh, the guard's a bit suspicious, but then there's a point where they're like, hey, look, there's a fucking man! That's when it goes into slow motion. And you get a few moments of slow motion where if you can headshot the guy and kill him, or trank him or whatever in that time, then it's fine, you got away with it, basically.
I really like that it properly makes a distinction between non-lethal and lethal, and it's the correct distinction, which is that man's still alive, and therefore can be helped. Like, anyone that you've tranked can be woken up by any other guard, which means it's a huge risk, and given how big the world is, and the chance for you to need to backtrack through areas, it makes a lot more sense, even after you've tranked somebody, to go up and shoot them in the head, just because it's way safer that way. And it's, you know, so to commit to a non-lethal playthrough is to take substantial extra risk. Sorry. It's not just a question of not getting to play with every toy, it's you take the chance of essentially never having anywhere that's safe, because dudes wake up.
it does, like, it forces you to embody that role in a really cool way, because as well, when you sneak up to someone and get within melee range, you can grab them from behind and hold a knife to their throat. At that point, you can either knock them out or kill them, but you can also interrogate them, at which point they'll give you a little bit of information about the base. So, give you information about where guards are posted, or where there are AA guns, or where there's a cache of weapons, or that sort of stuff. So you get into the habit of going out, grabbing people from behind, threatening them, asking them for information, and then once you've got the information, killing them anyway.
Yeah.
Which is horrible, but I like that it does sort of compel you towards that stuff.
How is it priced?
It's like, quite...
It's like...
15?
15, 20 pounds?
Something like that, yeah.
Hmm. Such a weird thing. Like, it's... if I imagine, like, them releasing, you know... a level of Deus Ex Human Revolution just as a full game, like at a lower price point, but just as a standalone thing, it would be so weird. And yet, like on PC, you could probably get away with it because, like on Steam in particular, like loads of people who play your thing are playing it because they've heard about it from an enthusiast gaming site and they know what it is and they know what to expect. It seems like such a crazy thing to, like, for a massive console franchise to release this new thing that's just totally unlike any other game in terms of, like, what you're getting. You're getting just one mission, and it's a really big and complex and interesting mission that you can replay loads of times, but it's just the one. And that seems to have, you know, it seems to have caused all of the upset that you might think it would cause.
Yeah, because it was a full-press release on console as well.
Oh,
it
right.
It was £40, which is
technically a bit less. But...
yeah, technically a bit less, but still pretty close. And, yeah, like, and it's not like it's called Metal Gear Solid 5, quite limited prologue.
Metal Gear Solid 5, just a bit of the next thing.
Yeah, it's called Metal Gear Solid 5 Ground Zeroes, which sounds like a game.
I mean, it's plural, so you'd expect at least one, two Ground Zeroes.
It's because it's so systemic, you can complete it in an hour. That's the thing. Like, so people completed it in an hour and went, what the fuck, this is bullshit! But you can replay it a ton of times and do it in different ways, and that's part of the fun of it. And there are lots of things to discover in that base. And that, like you say, is more common on PC and not at all on console. But it reminds me of, if you remember War Inspector's thing of, like, games being very big but very shallow rather than small and deep, and wanting to do like an apartment block, yeah. I think, which was just a single apartment block, but it's super fucking detailed and super deep. And this feels sort of like that. That's basically what they did. They took all the resources of a big company like Konami and threw a lot of people at it and a lot of artistry at it and made something that was very constrained, and it's brilliant for it.
And really, isn't Skyrim just one very big level?
Yeah.
With the same cave in it. But you do the cave a lot of different ways, too.
What game have you been playing which has levels in it which can be done lots of different ways?
Infinifactory, which I think is what Tom's been playing as well, predominantly. Yeah. So Infinifactory is a new game by Zachtronix, who also made Space Chem and Ironclad Tactics.
Hmm.
And I realised recently that I've reviewed like all of their games. Like, I reviewed Space Chem, one of the first games I ever reviewed professionally. I reviewed Ironclad Tactics. And this is my favourite game that he's made.
Hmm.
He also made Infiniminer.
He did make Infiniminer.
Which was a competitive building game in which you placed, like, meter-cubed blocks, you're digging out meter-cubed blocks competitively with other people. And he ran it as a multiplayer game for a while, and then the source code got leaked, I think, or something got leaked. And it enabled cheaters to kind of make their own hacks for it, and just ruined the competitive scene. And he posted on his blog saying, like, it was really upsetting thing for him. It basically ruined his game. Like, he just couldn't play the game anymore because there were so many cheaters. And he did a post saying, like, I don't know if I'll give up games forever, but I'm never making a game like this anymore. And then a guy called Marcus Person released a small demo of a thing that he said was an Infiniminer clone that he didn't have a name for it at that time, but then eventually he called it Minecraft. That did well.
And but that's how we got Terraria.
I talked to Zach Barth is the guy who is Zachtronix. Is it Zachtronix Industries?
Mm, yep.
And I actually interviewed him for PC Gamer at the time. And it's not at all bitter about it. He just would never have made Minecraft. He says he really actively dislikes a lot of what Minecraft does in terms of, like, it's just not his kind of game. It just, he sees it as a Skinner box. It's a thing where you hit something 10 times and then you get a reward, and then you use that thing to hit something else 5 times and get a reward. And he just doesn't, he would never have made that game, so he doesn't feel like he missed out on something that, you know, was rightfully his.
Hmm.
And InfiniFactory sort of combines SpaceChem and InfiniMiner.
Yeah, and there's a bit of, there's a lot of SpaceChem in there. There's a bit of Factorio in there, which is a great game I don't know if we've spoken about, which is a top-down isometric factory building game. But yeah, to explain what you do, it is a game about being given various bits through inputs that kind of spew cubes or parts or assembled components onto a level, and having to assemble those pieces, to build a machine that will assemble those pieces into the desired thing that is laid out for you as kind of a hologram at the end of the level. So, by laying down conveyor belts and blocks and rotatey things and weldy things and things that destroy blocks and lift them or push them or whatever, you build essentially a train track that acts as a kind of automated factory, and that's where the name comes from. So it's a little bit like SpaceChem, in the SpaceChem was sort of the same thing with chemistry, but it's substantially less abstract, and the nature of the train tracks you're laying out are slightly different. You don't have, like, the operator that moves around the track as you did in SpaceChem. And there's a kind of, because it's in 3D, there's a sort of physics and physical dimension that's slightly different. Like, it has almost an element of slapstick to it that SpaceChem doesn't have. It's also, it's got a little bit more to the presentation. So at the beginning of the game, when you first load it up, you are abducted by aliens from your car, where you're driving down a sort of highway at night, and there's it's like a hard hat and some blueprints on the passenger seat, so the implication is that you're an engineer of some kind. And the intro kind of veers between quite dark, like you find a lot of, they're called failure tapes, but they're audio logs basically of other people who've been abducted and failed or whatever task they've been given. But your captors are aliens who are basically, it's very Hitchhiker's Guide. It's got a lot of, like, they're kind of like the Vogons.
I immediately thought Vogons when I saw.
Yeah. And they set you to work, creating factories for them. And as you find more audio logs, you realize that these people just like humans because they're good at making machines. So they kidnap humans until they run out of humans. And you're kind of teleported down to these sort of like hovering rocks on the surface of barren alien worlds or floating platforms amid fleets of starships and told to build whatever it is they want you to build. And then that sort of provides the structure between missions. You go back to your cell and you pick new missions from the TV screen in your cell. And one of my favorite missions later on has you build that cell, which I really like. And then there's lots of little jokes and stuff like when you finish a set of levels and you get your performance review, you stand in front of a board of aliens who sort of barble at you completely unintelligibly, and then they give you your reward, which is like a school gymnastics trophy that they've found, or a VHS about armpits, and a live chicken. And then you can do various things with those things and take them back to your room.
I don't know if this is the only way to do it, but when I was given my trophy or whatever, I got back to my room, I pressed the button I think it told me to press, and my guy just hurled it across the room, and it just like crashes into your sideboard and falls on the floor. That was it, and I just went on to the next mission.
I genuinely placed mine on the bed. But there's a lot I really like about it. It's immensely deep in terms of, like SpaceChem, in terms of not having really any prescribed solutions for problems. And it doesn't really punish. Basically, you've got to produce 10 of a thing. Every time you've got to produce 10 of a thing. So your machine has to be able to repeat to some degree. You know, it has to be able to, you know, you can't have so much waste or so much inefficiency that your machine works once and then breaks. But other than that, it doesn't really, like, it doesn't mark you down for wasting lots of the material it spouts at you or for using way too many pieces. It doesn't give you a budget for how many pieces you can use, although you unlock more blocks over time. So, you know, you can go back and try different things. But and the scoring system is instead based on how few, you know, how little real estate you use, how many machine cycles, which is sort of like internal ticks, it takes for you to complete all 10. And there's vast scope for doing things more or less efficiently. And like SpaceChem, and something I loved about that game, you find yourself internalizing ways of doing things that might not be the only way of doing things, but because it's how you figured out how to do something, it's how you do it every time from then on. So the example I would give is, I found a way that I like to essentially divide an output into two outputs. So if you have blocks coming down the conveyor belt, sometimes you'll need to turn that into two streams of blocks going in different directions, so you can do one thing with one set and another thing with the other set. And I have a way of doing that that involves having one block stop, having the block behind it push it onto another pad that activates a pusher, which pushes the original block off somewhere else, and they move on to different tracks and it sort of splits them. That's a sort of an efficient 50-50 split. But there are other ways of doing stuff like that, and there are ways.
Yeah, I think mine is like, I have a sensor and then just put the pusher like two blocks back or something, so that when block one hits the sensor, block two is just in front of the pusher, and the pusher puts it onto the parallel track that's next to it.
Yeah, yeah. And so you kind of come up with your own methods, but you get later in the game and you realize that maybe some method that you've internalized that you've been doing since for 20 missions is actually not as good as it could be. So it's not about ultimately finding the solution that designer laid out for you. It's about literally building one. And I am appalling at it. I'm more than halfway through it, but I'm appalling at it not because I can't beat the missions, because I can, but because my solutions are dreadful. My machines are awful. I've been posting some GIFs of them, and, you know, one of them, it just accidentally also made benches. Like, what I was making was a forklift, but occasionally it would output a bench, and eventually the benches would be able to fill up. So I have a little part of the machine. I was like, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound at this point. I have an extra part of the machine that's only job is to quietly tip the benches into the ravine. Like, there's no penalty for that other than it's a dreadful machine. Like, I've used, that was like 600 cycles, whereas my friend did it in 110 or something.
It sounds weirdly like programming.
Yeah, there's a lot of programming too. Actually, my friend Dan, who's really good at it, is a programmer. I'm not. There's no better proof that I have a humanities degree than the things I've built in that game. So you're building these appalling machines, partly on purpose now, just to see like how dreadful a kind of wasteful contraption I can build. Doing things in really convoluted sort of is it Van Buren machines?
Rube Goldberg?
Rube Goldberg machines. Where do we get Van Buren from?
The Fallout sequel that was never made?
Yeah, I guess so. Rube Goldberg machines. I think, yeah. Rube Goldberg-esque kind of like, you know, things that rattle and fall apart, but still kind of get your 10 things built at the end of the day. And weirdly, when I started to get better at it, or especially when I had luck, it started to almost cheapen my experience of building really, truly awful machines. Like, I had one where I just managed to look into some amazing timing that I could have worked out if I was a genius, but two pieces consistently arrived at the same place perfectly, which removed the need for a kind of mechanical function. So, because the two blocks would kind of bump into each other and both go in the right direction, but only because they collided. So I didn't need a block there or something just to create that. Mm. It just sort of happened, and it looks amazing. It looks really elegant. Like, they're, you know, they're just, the machine kind of builds itself at that point. It doesn't need a lot of extra conveyor belts or anything. But no, that was pure incompetence. Like, I had no idea that was going to happen.
I find I get really attached to like the particular way I've done something, and so often it's just a quirk of the way I built things. And there's no penalty for rebuilding, so if you design something and it doesn't quite work out the way you want it, you just press a button to test it. You can even press a button, like a fast forward key, to just see it roll out really quickly, and you see the problem pretty soon. I had one where I was trying to build a rocket, and it gives you all the different chunks of a rocket, like four or five different segments, and they have to be piled on top of each other in a certain order. And when they got to, you can kind of drop them off a cliff, which means, okay, if you drop the base thing off a cliff and then move it along a conveyor belt so it's underneath where the next module should drop on, it could land on it. And you can do various tricks to make sure it stops at the right place and stuff. And I got most of it working, but then I needed to like weld them together. And the way I'd arranged it was just really awkward to get a welder to, if I put a welder like next to the block in the direction I wanted to do it, it would be blocking other blocks from coming into the actual welding area. So I had to build another conveyor belt that would just go around the welding thing, and so it would just go like in a tiny, tiny little loop and move the whole rocket in this like really rapid little curl. I loved it. It was like my own little like weird detour that all my rockets take before they're built.
There's a second rocket building one later. which doesn't give you the cliff, so it challenges you to use a different piece to build a vertical thing when all of your blocks start on the ground. Lifting is one of the things it restricts you from doing early, to kind of build the puzzles around. And I built something that was almost like a complete enclosure. I don't know why I built it this way. It obviously wastes points in terms of the amount of blocks I used, but I built it so that it was this sort of like box. So if you were standing near where the output is, where you need to get the rocket to, you just see just this stuff shaking and rattling about and sense of movement between columns of just blocks. But then a rocket emerges, just a perfect rocket, just from nowhere. And inside, it's madness. Like, it's things being thrown up in the air and, like, caught by conveyor belts that move them and drop them in the right order. There are some really cool, like, it changes, which I think I burned out on Space Game a bit, because when Space Game wanted to do something different, it did something timed, which is a very different kind of challenge. And it sort of, I mean, getting through that stuff was really hard, but hard wasn't really what I wanted necessarily. I wanted to be forced to be more creative or more intelligent in my own time, I guess. And Infinite Factory does that really well. There are later missions. I worry that this is spoilers, but I don't think it is. There are missions later on, that you gain the ability to destroy blocks, with a drill, basically. And the reason you need that is you have a run of missions which are not actually about building something, but about repairing something. And so, the thing you're given, the thing that's output from the emitter, is in the first case it's a shuttle, but it's like a big rectangular chassis with a cockpit and two engines on either side. And the one you're given has engines that are cracked and broken and shitty.
All right.
And the one you have to give at the end of the conveyor belt is the one you have to give at the end of the conveyor belt, and it's sort of a linear path from entrance to exit. Is a shuttle with two fixed engines. And you have an emitter, a single emitter, that outputs engine pieces. And the engine pieces are sort of rocket-shaped, but horizontal. And so the challenge is not just, it's strip the old engines off the ship, fit two new engines to it, and then send it onto its destination. And that's, when you make that one work, it feels really cool, because you've set up... It's something, it's even more satisfying in a way than building something, because it's like, you've kind of created this you're sort of smartly recalibrating an object as it moves through 3D space. It's really fun. That one has one of my favorite fuck-ups ever, where I had a really, like, quite elegant system for building the rockets, rotating them into place, slapping them onto either side of the shuttle. But I didn't have a proper queuing system, like a logic-driven queuing system for the shuttles that are entering behind the one that's currently having rockets fitted to it. Because obviously they keep coming. You don't choose when the next one comes in. You have to time it so that you have motion going constantly. And this led to an accident where the first shuttle was fine, but every subsequent shuttle was then welded to the first shuttle. and basically I gave them one gigantic, like, four shuttle long mega shuttle with engines stapled wherever it could figure out to staple engines to this mega chassis. And when you give the output something it doesn't want, you get a screen that flashes up that's like, I wanted this, you gave this. And it's like, wanted shuttle with engines, got infinity mega shuttle.
Do you see? Yeah.
And after I had to build like a gating system so that it would only let the next shuttle through when the previous one had gone and that kind of thing. Hmm. There's one later on in the same vein where you have to repair a tank, but the things that are broken on the tank are on the front and the back. So you have to like, move it through the drills that will get rid of the bad bits in such a way that you don't take away the good bits, because you don't have the bits to replace anything. You can only build the stuff you need to remove. So you have to kind of like shunt the tank through a series of drills to kind of like get rid of the turret and the command thing that's broken.
Are there still 10 of these?
Yeah.
So we have 10 tanks that were wind damaged exactly the same way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The kind of implications about what you're building are kind of, it varies. Like sometimes you're building military gear and sometimes you're building commercial stuff. One of them is just building a sofa. But, and as I said, one of the ones that almost feels more like a jigsaw, the rest of it feels really creative. One of the ones that really feels like a jigsaw puzzle is one where you have to assemble your own cell. Because you're given the bits like the TV and the washer dresser and the bed as whole parts, but they kind of come out all at once. And so you've got to find a machine that kind of catches all of these different parts of a room and drops them in place, because the room you're doing this in is enclosed, unlike a lot of the game spaces which are open to the sky. So you don't have room to kind of separate everything out, get it perfect, and then drop it into place slowly, you have to kind of create this kind of crazy system for like depositing everything in a room into place and welding it into place while it's moving, which is kind of nuts.
I really like it. I'm glad to hear that like that repairing stuff sounds really cool, and I'm glad to hear that it doesn't just sort of, you know, introduce some horrible timing element or get brutally difficult. When I'm playing it, I always have the sense that it's almost too hard. I'm just on the cusp. Every new mission, apparently John Walker said exactly this in his RPS verdict, but I was saying also that at the end of every mission, it gives you like a survey because it's still in early access, and they want to know, was the mission too hard or just right or too easy? Was it interesting and was it fun? And I'm always answering, it was too hard, and yes, it was interesting, and yes, it was fun. So in what sense was it too hard?
Yeah.
I don't know. It just kind of felt like at any minute you're going to fuck me. You're just going to do something that I won't understand at all and I have to give up on it. Because I kind of did get to that point with Space Chem a little bit. Or I don't think it was the timing stuff. I think with Space Chem, you were saying earlier, Graham, it sounded like programming. And Space Chem did feel like programming to me. And I stopped playing it partly because I was like, I can actually program. I could just go and make a program, and that would be fun in the same way as this is, and at the end of it, I would have a game. So,
and the rest is...
Then I make gunpoint. But Infinity Factory doesn't give me that because, I think because it's less abstract and because you see all the bits, I know what I'm making, and I understand why that welds to that, and I understand that now those are welded, of course they'll be pushed together, and... it just relates to much more relatable rules, physics things that we already understand. So that makes it less... It's still an automation task, and it's still about sort of learning a language and using it to express something, but it's much more satisfying when it's things you can sort of see and understand.
Do you get that feeling the puzzle games give you of, you know, enlightenment when your head pops and you suddenly get a new thing, or is it does the creativity of it mean that it's not really doing that sort of thing that, say, Braid would?
I'd say 100% yes. Like, there are definitely moments where you... And this is what's interesting about it, and I think what makes it more interesting, like, and this is something that's kind of specific to Zachtronics games quite a lot of the time, is it's the same feeling, but in a way it's more gratifying because you don't have the eureka moment because you've figured out what the design is waiting for you to figure out. It's because you've solved a problem with your own design. And it still feels the same way. It's like when you realize that, oh, I can actually make this faster, or I can make this simpler.
Hang on, this would work.
Yeah. But you might not be stumbling across the best solution, you know, and then you get the leaderboard at the end. It's like someone's done that in 100 cycles faster than me.
I've been like almost always just the worst in every dimension at the end of every I'm all my friends have just done this way better than me.
But the eureka moments are still there, and they still feel really good because you've you realize actually I can do this with much less pieces, or you know, something kind of just, you definitely have those moments where it clicks in your brain. Like, I was playing it and I called around the guys in the office to have a look at a solution that came up, which was atrocious, but kind of probably would sell you the game because it was so convoluted. And then immediately afterwards, I think I saw Tom Senior firing it up to play it, and he was kind of working his way through the very, very earliest missions, which I remember not struggling with, but having to sit and go, hang on, how do I do this? And I was watching him sit through the same experience of, hang on, how do I do this? And I was watching it like, that's just the easiest thing in the entire world. Like, my brain has been enlarged without me really knowing that it's been enlarged by the game. Like, I just know stuff about how conveyor belts work now and how you might redirect something or more efficient ways of moving things. And so that comes from a series of those moments where you go, oh, actually, don't need this many pieces. Don't need that many pieces. This will do this if I manipulate it in this way.
Yeah, I think it's a really good balance in that it does have... it has, like, the aha moment, but instead of it being, aha, I found the solution, it's you found your own solution, you invented it, like you say. But it still does have the thing that I like in a really good prescriptive puzzle game, which is that every new puzzle seems totally impossible. When they first read it, you're like, it just can't be done, because of this, and this. Oh, wait, hang on, if I did something like that. So you still have that moment of, like, solving something that you previously thought was impossible, but you get to kind of feel like you weren't just putting something in the slot that it was supposed to be in. Yeah. Even though that is literally what you do.
And, like, you create these little mental And it's not just about mastering techniques. You kind of create, you invent, like, not even systems, but, like, concepts for yourself that I don't necessarily know if every other player uses. But one of the things, for example, you might, a really good example of the type of thing, the type of puzzle that sets you out to solve is you're making a device or a construction that uses one of one type of block and in various different configurations, 10 of another type of block. But those two blocks are emitted at roughly the same rate. You know, maybe the block you need less of is emitted half as fast as the other one, but you need 10 of the other one. So you're always going to have one of your materials coming out, and you can't stop them coming out, you can't choose when they come out, coming out at a rate far faster than the one you need to do far more preparation with. And so I created systems for building what basically amounts to clips of ammo. So if I build, I just started calling it a clip in my head, which is when I kind of build, like, stock, allow the thing I need fewer of to build up in reservoirs that's specifically constructed so they will just gather that stuff in a way that I can then trigger a little pushy thing to shove one on whenever I need one. So you create a dispenser, basically. So you, from the very beginning, my wooden blocks are being manipulated in a dozen different ways to create two really complex constructions. And then when they're in place and they're ready to be mixed with the one thing I need to link them together or whatever, that's when I trigger it and dispense one thing from my clip. But I don't know if that's necessarily the best way of doing that. But it's a concept and that I've used in a dozen different levels. The idea of the kind of the ammo store of the thing you need lots of or you need fewer of. Well, the thing you need lots of is machined and sort of like hot off the press when it's combined into the final product is a kind of set of concepts that I kind of came up with myself over 10 hours of solving puzzles in that game and I'm still using. And that's really gratifying because it might be wrong, which for some reason makes it even better that someone asks, like, why do you have this wonky looking stack of blocks that you're just dispensing from?
Yeah, it's interesting. Kind of idea, because most puzzle games do sort of, they beat out of you any personal quirks, because if you're doing it a certain way, then the next level will be the one where you have to do it in only, using only 10 blocks or whatever. They'll enforce the efficiency to make sure you learn the right way of doing it. God damn it, learn that there's a perfect way of doing this. And then once you learn that, you just use that again and again, because now you know it's the only way you should do it. But yeah, it kind of, it's weird, because it does judge you on efficiency, but like I said, it never requires it, so it's kind of, lets you keep all your quirks, lets you be weird about it.
Yeah. There are a few interesting things as well. Like, there's a button I did not know was there. There are a few keyboard shortcuts that are really helpful that it doesn't tell you about. But one of them is you can speed up the rate at which things are emitted into the level. And that's not on a per dispenser basis, so that would fundamentally change the nature of some of the puzzles. It's just, you know, if it's at the current interval so that, you know, it basically speeds up the rate of, essentially, I guess, the ticks that are going on under the surface. So if one dispenser is emitting at one times speed and one's dispensing at two times speed, you just multiply both of those rates by whatever you decide to speed it up or slow it down by. But that fundamentally changes how machines work. So if your machine works at default speed, it probably doesn't work at max speed. Because blocks will come out so fast that this construction you've, you know, designed that requires blocks to punt each other off cliffs at a certain rate won't work anymore. So the time increases, but the space is still finite, and that creates these situations where your machine's completely different. And if you want the really high scores, you kind of have to build a machine that works at max dispense rate. Like, if you want to get the when I say high scores, I mean really low completion rates. And that involves building a completely different type of machine to the one that you need to get through the level. So, in a couple of ways, like, there are, like, lots of different ways your machine can be bad. Like, it can be the most efficient way of solving the puzzle at the default rate, but it might not even work if you tick up the dispense rate by one. Which is kind of crazy. It kind of exponentially increases the amount of potential solutions you'd need to come up with for a given puzzle. And I'm really enjoying just playing through it as an idiot. But, like, the scope there for, I don't know, seriously going back and mastering something is massive. The other thing that maybe all games should have, this game definitely should, is at any point, so the way you control it is you move around the first person, but you have a jetpack that functionally allows you to hover anywhere, so you can fly basically around the space in 3D, which is necessary to get perspective on things. So what you can do is you can fly up above a construction, as long as it's a construction. I think you can do it anyway, but it especially it works really well if it's a construction that is finished, basically. So it does its repeating, you know, manufacturing pattern. You can fly up above it, pick an angle, look down on it, and press F10, and it will generate a GIF, a looping GIF of your solution that saves to your desktop, and you can just like drag it onto GiffyCat or whatever and immediately get a GIF that you can share. And it like, I think it down renders the game slightly, and it obviously outputs a smaller image, but it's sort of a manageable size, and it does it really quickly. And because it doesn't actually just play through, it doesn't like play through and screen cap. It just generates it because it knows what.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It does it.
Wow, that's clever.
So it does it sort of procedurally. Which so
it's using your camera angle, but then it's actually recording some stuff that you personally don't see, I guess.
You see it kind of do it in fast motion. Like it opens up a window and goes like, figuring this out, doing it. And you get these GIFs you can share. So like last night I was between Dota games, I was on Skype, with friends who were all playing it. And I was like, oh man, this machine is dreadful, but it works. And I'd press F10 and then like, you know, drag it into GiffyCat, share a link straight away. And you can kind of check out each other's designs like that. And that's, what's really cool about it is because it's so creative, it's kind of hard to spoil. Like, you know, if you're looking at a GIF, you don't necessarily understand exactly how something works.
Yeah, I certainly don't understand how yours works.
Yeah, I mean, after this, I'm going to show you guys one or two of them. Because really, like, it's weird how, like, I shared a really inefficient design and one of my friends just cracked up. It was the one with the bench removal device, because there is some sort of mild slapstick in, like, where's that bench going? Why did you even accidentally make a bench? Like, Space Cam couldn't be funny, and this can. And even though, it's got scripted humor and unplanned humor in the cutscene-y bits, but it's weirdly funny as well. Like,
I like you as the manager of a, you know, a company with, like, dumping benches into a river. Like,
we don't know why we made these.
Getting sanctioned for your bench pollution.
Exactly. And actually, it reminds me a lot of Aperture Science.
Mm.
You know, they're just making weird shit and then they're not really having any idea why they're making it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really good. Like, it's easily, it's not a lot of competition, but it's my favourite game that I've played this year in terms of something new. Like, it's really
amazing because this is like, it just launched into early access. This is like the first early access version, and usually stuff fucking sucks at this point. Like,
yeah, it's weird. Like, I'm writing an early access review for PC Gamer, so it's not going to have a score on it. And I don't know if I'll end up writing the review, but I feel ready to put a number on it, and it's a high number. Like,
he says on the, I don't know if it's on the early access page, but he said when he released it, this would normally be the point at which he would release it as a finished game. Right. It was finished, but he wants to put it out as early access because he wants to get feedback so he can make it better because now he can. But he says that normally this would just be the thing that he would release, like Space Game, as you know, this is done now.
That's really interesting because that's the only thing that's tempted me to do early access is like, don't actually do early access, but just when you release your game, just call it early access and then see what breaks and then fix it and then say, okay, now we've got the release. But also, it's almost an argument against it because I didn't know that. I thought this was just an early access release and they're going to do loads more to it, so maybe I shouldn't be playing it. And, the main thing I wonder about it is that maybe when it does come out, everyone will be like, didn't that already come out? Like, it just won't cause the buzz that it would have if it came out all at once.
It does create a weird position for me. Like, I'm now making, this is maybe from an indie marketing point of view, like, I'm now trying to figure out, like, it's basically ready to review. In a lot of ways, like, it costs 20 quid. It feels complete. The developer says it's basically complete, but it's in early access, so I don't feel like I can put a score on it. But it would feel really weird to run two reviews on the site in succession.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're discussing this. I don't know what exactly we'll do, but it's like, are we going to do something in the magazine? Because we don't know when it's going to come out and it feels very current. And it's very good. So it makes sense to put it in the magazine. And we'll probably put the review in the magazine as well eventually, but it'll be separated by a couple of months. If it comes out of that kind of place, the magazine cycle, if it comes out next in a couple of weeks, or it comes out in a month when he's sort of happy with the feedback and he's implemented some changes, it would feel really weird to have two reviews on the site, like, in succession. So do we just wait for the one we can put a score on it? It's strange. It means we're kind of less inclined to cover it in detail around its point of sale because you don't really know what it is. It's tricky. I guess it's a problem that you get when you put scores on things and you have a policy that says you don't put scores on early access things because, you know, you take the developer's word for it, but when the developer's saying, I would normally release this, but I'm not. it creates a weird situation, and I guess from a marketing point of view for the developer, it's like, you probably get you don't get double the coverage for releasing it twice, basically.
Yeah. No, but I don't think you get necessarily less coverage. I think you probably still get more coverage.
It's whether coverage arrives at the right times, I guess.
But I think that there's a kind of, there's an exponential thing with trying to make something into news, where if you don't hit a certain threshold, then certain sites won't report on it at all. So the fact that you had two things they didn't report on it at all is not better than having one thing they might report on it.
No. But then I think he's done quite a good thing in that he only announced the game, I think, like 2 months ago, 6 weeks ago,
yeah,
or something.
It was pretty...
And it's called Infini Factory, and it's by the Space Cam guy, and it's a lot like Space Cam, but it's got Infini at the start of it, which is a lot like Infini Miner, which is another game he made before, which went on to become Minecraft. And so it's like, initially, like, as soon as he announces that game, I have 5 paragraphs to write about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's the easiest fucking game in the world to write about. In terms of just, I don't know anything about this game, but I already know so much about it that I can just...
It's basically a great story behind it already. Like.
Yeah. And then 6 weeks later, it's out and you can now play it. It's like, that feels exciting in a way that a lot of indie games don't, because they get announced. And then a year later, there's a Kickstarter. And then a year and a half later, there's an early access release. And then, like, it's also dragged out. Whereas this feels that maybe just by sheer momentum, even if it gets a proper release in 2 months' time or 3 months' time, which would be relatively short early access period, that would still feel exciting in a way that...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's knocked it out of the park. Like, you know, from announcing it a couple of months ago to putting it in early access as easily one of the best games in early access... And probably the best game of the year so far.
Wow.
Like,
just making a good game sort of overrated.
It does, it really does. Like, I'd be happy to cover it twice. It will get coverage one way or another. It's just, it's whether or not, like, I think it would work for this game, the kind of early access release, and it's already really good. If the game was bad, but the developer released it saying it was basically finished,
yeah,
that would
be
creates
bad.
Such a weird situation for a critic, where it's like, I really want to pan this twice. It's dead good, though. Everyone should play it. It's, yeah, no, I can't think of anything else that's come out this year that's anywhere near as good.
It does also affect your perception as a player. Like, I think I would have played more of it by now if that was the final release. But because it was early access, I actually kind of thought it was about to end, like, all times, basically. I was like, okay, I got the idea, I guess this is, like, the prototype thing, and they'll take it from here. But yeah, you're always left wondering what this is, like, whether you should even expect it to carry on. The fact that it kept asking me whether it was too hard or not, that was part of what made me think it's going to get really fucking hard any minute, because clearly they haven't balanced it, they don't know, you know, whether it's too hard or not. And actually, if that was taken out... it's perfectly balanced. It's really well paced, and you're always discovering new things, but it's never too overwhelming. And I had no reason from the actual game itself to think, you know, I'm not going to enjoy this entire thing, and it's going to be a full game length thing that I would be able to play all the way through and really enjoy. But it was constantly sort of saying, are we doing it right? I think we're going to fuck it up. Have we fucked it up yet? Well, it seems like we're going to fuck it up. Also, this is early access, and please don't blame us. And so eventually, I think I just stopped because I was, you know, it was really late at night. But the reason I haven't gone back to it, I think, is because I'm kind of half thinking it might not be ready yet. And I, but the game itself has given me no reason to suspect that at all.
The difficulty thing, like, every puzzle in the game now, I've done, like, this was just right. I enjoyed it, like, for every single one. Because I felt like that after I've solved every single one. But there's been one or two in, like, the latter half of the game, which I felt were too easy. Or, like, weren't as challenging as previous ones. Like, the one that came immediately after the fucking build an apartment one was like, I can do this in my sleep. But I ended up going with that was just right anyway, because I was like, what are you doing? They'll hear you. Like, this was a break. Don't
tell the Vogons that you weren't working at capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you could really drag me into the ground. I would be fine with it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, just, it was nice to have one that was relatively straightforward, especially because it was one that was teaching you a new bit. So it was like, it'd given you a new block, and it's like, they tend to do slightly simpler puzzles when you're given a new tool. And I was like, that's fine. It's fine. Shh. It's fine.
It's actually, it's made me rethink how Because I do quite a similar thing. I did a similar thing with Gunpoint, where I ask people, what did you think of this level? What do you think of that level? What do you think of that level? In a much less elegant way, because I had to fill out a separate form back when I was testing it. But now I realize, like, asking someone, was that too hard, is actually more ambiguous than it seems, because when I answered that question, I said yes, even though I enjoyed it, even though I found it interesting. And so really the question is, like, was that so hard that you didn't enjoy it? Or was that so hard that you found it frustrating?
It's interesting with stuff like that. Like, any time I see that kind of question, or see that a developer is asking those questions, I'm nervous that they're going to read the information wrong.
Yeah. But hopefully the good thing about this is that doing it in early access rather than like a closed beta is it'll probably have loads of data. We'll have loads and loads and loads of responses, so it'll have like a really good... I mean, it was... At Gunpoint, I basically just asked people, did they like the level or did they not like the level? And even that was just fantastic. Like, get 1,000 people to say that, and you know for sure, this level fucking sucks. Level 6, I'm just deleting it. I'm not going to try and fix it. It's a train wreck. Just set fire to it, walk away. Make a whole new level 6.
It looks like... I haven't tried any, but it looks like there's Steam Workshop support as well for like custom levels and things, so it's obviously a natural fit because it's a block-based puzzle game.
Yeah.
And with that, like, I'm actually, for once in a puzzle game, kind of interested in doing that. Like, I made some portal levels and things, but I am actually kind of interested in... Because you're asking someone else to be creative, I don't necessarily want to necessarily make something that I know how to solve. What I want to do is create a gargantuan knob as a target, give people like one block type, and just go. Build this.
Just a cheap way of getting a giant knob. Yeah. I can't be bothered to build a giant knob. You build the giant knob.
Exactly. I'm going to outsource building a giant knob to Steam Workshop.
This is the natural evolution of Minecraft. Instead of building the giant knob yourself, make a challenge for other people.
I love that. It's so cool. Yeah, man, it'd be amazing if you could import things that were made, like, if there was a game that went with Infinity Factory where you played as, like, the alien race, but just, it was Minecraft, basically, so, but if you wanted something, you just sort of said what you wanted, and it would eventually come through a portal, because somewhere an Infinity Factory player was making it for you.
And I want 10 of them for some reason.
That'd be amazing. God, they should make that. Because I know he doesn't want to make Minecraft, but that's how you then, like, undermine Minecraft, by, like, you just live in a life of idleness. Everything is made for you by processes you never see. And it's some sort of comment, isn't it?
I guess the interesting thing about this is it is very Minecraft-y in that it's... The way you play it is just like Minecraft creative mode, where you can hover and move around like your perspective and everything is the same, not coincidentally. And it's on Steam. Minecraft isn't.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of an interesting thing. Like, it's also like the way Redstone works in Minecraft, you can do all of that in Infinity Factory. It has its own wiring system and the logic gates and stuff like that. You can make something that is Turing complete. You can make a basically a computer in it that can then process programs and things. You know, there's no limit on what you can do in that way. So anyone who's into that stuff, who is on Steam, now there's a Steam game where you can do that. There are loads of like shitty Minecraft clones on Steam. Obviously, there's all those survival terrain thingies. You know, they're survival terrain games. They're all shit, I hear. Having not played any of them. But, I mean, there was a big... When Early Access comes up as a debate, one of the big arguments against it is... I can't remember its name, but there was a game that looked a bit like Minecraft that was one of the early Greenlight successes, and then it was released in Early Access, and it was fucking terrible, and they never fixed it, and I think it's still in that state. I'm actually glad I can't remember the name, because I wouldn't want to like whoever it is.
Someone did a shit game.
Yeah. And can't we all agree? That was shit.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Why not? Now, because we were really late asking for questions, we actually have loads of them, but I'm going to have to read them off my monitor. So if you can hear clicking and, I don't know, other computer sounds, that's why. Don't be alarmed. Your real computer isn't being clicked. If you're in a car, there's no need to panic.
Tell your friends that have ASMR.
Click, click. Omar writes, boss fights in FPSs, can they actually work without ending up a huge pain in the ass?
I actually think, like, well, yeah, okay. Most first-person shooter boss fights suck ass. But there are a bunch that I've enjoyed almost in spite of themselves. A good example, I think, is Serious Sam 1, which had a boss fight at the end of it, which was fucking ginormous. And I think maybe, did it have jump pads? Or am I maybe mistaking that for an id game? But it was a boss that was like 40 or 50 times larger than the player character. And I had never seen an enemy in a first person game before that was that big. And like Serious Sam, it's kind of overwhelming scale was mostly about the number of enemies that threw at you at any one time, and that was what made it exciting. And so it was sort of the perfect thematic boss for that game. Yeah. It was just one enemy, but it was a really big enemy. And having something that you could look up at, but also it moved in a first person game in, must have been 1999, maybe, for Serious Sam 1 or something like that, was like super impressive and in keeping with the game. And my complaint about boss fights in most games is that they don't, like, there are no skills in Half-Life 1 that you learn through the course of playing the game that really help you defeat the giant floating space baby that you, whose brains you blow out at the end.
I was going to use Half-Life 1 as my example, but I was going to qualify the tentacle monster in the missile silo as a boss fight, and being one of my favourite FPS boss fights.
That was the point at which I gave up on the game.
Really?
And I thought, this is too hard, I don't want to do this, I'm giving up. And it was 6 months later when a friend called me to say that they were hooked on Half-Life, and they told me how to defeat that boss. Which, in retrospect... probably quite a stupid kid.
I found it incredibly brutal and unforgiving, and it doesn't really... There's some inconsistencies with it, too. It's like it behaves a little bit weirdly, like it doesn't totally make sense for what they say it can and can't do.
I think there is a character that says, it's you or something like that. Like, there's a dying Barney at the door.
But there's stuff you can do that makes noise that the tentacle doesn't react to, and there's stuff that you can do that doesn't make a lot of noise that it does react to.
Still a cool moment.
I really like when it bursts through the window and like drags off the, well, what you now think and of as the Kleiner.
I think it's, even if the, like, even given that, I think it's still a good boss because it's kind of, that's what a boss should be. Like, it should be difficult. It should be something that you hit a brick wall with a little bit. But it should be, the way you succeed is by just fundamentally changing your understanding of what it is and what it does, rather than just, oh, you should have put more bullets into it. What you should have done is avoided the damage and then dealt more damage. And that would have been the winning strategy.
Yeah. I quite like the Big Mama in Half-Life 1. Didn't like the Garg so much, which is the kind of bipedal one that shoots flames out of its arms.
But I can't believe neither of you guys have mentioned the glowing orb at the end of Half-Life 2. It had three different metal barriers. You had to get rid of the three metal barriers and then destroy
the flaps.
Surely that was the best
off
spot.
The flaps with your physics
throwing
balls.
The balls at the flaps. Didn't you like that?
Yeah, it was weird.
Good job it's not the end of that game or the last we'll see of that series. I suppose that's really the end of Half-Life 2 episode 2.
But Bama was cool both for... Like, I quite enjoyed fighting it. I think it was just basically a bullet sponge, but it shits little baby head crabs at you.
So which game?
Half-Life 1.
You're talking about the Gonok?
Yeah, but it's also called the Big Mama, which I think is maybe just because of its file name or something like that, but it's like a head crab mother. It births them.
The walking bollock.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the reasons that I like it, though. Because I think it's in Raising the Bar, the Making of Half-Life 2 book, which also has a bunch of Half-Life 1 stuff in it. And there's comments from like Gabe Newell about hiring the artist who did a lot of the monster design in Half-Life 1, and hiring that guy in an interview, him saying like, what are teenage boys, young teenage boys, actually afraid of?
Bollocks. Walking bollocks.
And like a lot of the original enemy designs were like that in some way. Like there was the Mr. Friendly that would kind of
he just fucking
dry hump you. Yeah, basically. And so it was just like preying on 13-year-old boys' fear of their own genitalia. Or
I mean, it's true. I am scared of being raped at almost any age, really.
Which seemed like a really interesting thing. Like, it was like a specifically anti, sort of like the Quake idea of, I'm just a big brute and I've got lots of muscles. And like, the Big Mama is the kind of ultimate expression of that. Like, it is literally giving birth as you fight it. Like, it's spewing out little baby head crabs. Like a gross seahorse?
Can we answer a different question?
Yeah, we should move on.
Pierre writes, as most of you review games or have, what is the one thing that you could ignore about a game for a review and still have it be an accurate representation of the game?
I have used an example of this in sort of explaining like game design philosophy, because there's a lot of like a lot of people making games really care about very small things and think that they're very important, and in particular like the way menus work, like the fact that menu objects shouldn't just appear on screen, they should slide in from the side, or they should fade in, and they should do this special transition stuff. And I have said that, you know, when I was reviewing games, there were some games that were console ports where the menus just, like, barely fucking worked. They were just an absolute torture to use every time you use them, because they weren't designed for mouse. So you do things like move the mouse over a menu option, and it wouldn't highlight because it didn't know you moved it too fast, and it couldn't keep up with it. So it thought you were still selecting the quit button. So when you try to click options, it would actually quit the game. And it's utter bullshit, and it was just atrocious. But I don't think I ever actually removed even a percentage point from a game for that, because it doesn't actually fucking matter. You just get on with it. You just get past it and play the fucking game, and the game is what actually matters.
I think it's quite genre dependent, and so there's like a Conrad quote about story in games is a lot like story in porn. It's nice if it's there, but you don't necessarily expect it. And I don't, like, we all kind of chuckle now, ha ha ha, not having a story in a first person game, how wrong he was, because first-person games are one of the genres which are best known for having their stories now. But I think that's because the first-person games that id were making at that point were totally in a different genre from the ones that are being made now.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, story was completely fucking irrelevant in Quake and Quake 2 and Quake 3, and that wasn't just a stupid design decision, that was the nature of the way those games played.
It was a screen of text you got when you finished the chapter, when you finished the 12 levels that were the chapter. It would say, and then you freed Earth from the evil Martian alien hell demons.
Yeah. It's like that was just that genre of game that id made. Counting that as a different genre from just playing first-person shooter, because that's a stupid fucking name for a genre, didn't require a story. Like, I would never play Quake 3 and go, the story's not very good, is it? So it feels like a genre thing to me, more than a game-specific, overall game thing.
I agree with Graham.
Cool.
Games Folks writes, who would you rather have as your dad, Jeff Bridges or Martin Sheen?
I've had some time to think about this. And I'm going to go for Martin Sheen. Because Jeff Bridges, yeah. I have conflicting kind of like impressions of, because he's been in a lot of films that I've seen, and some of them he's evil.
That's his problem as an actor, is he's yeah. portrayed too many roles, and now he could be evil or he could be good.
Whereas Martin Sheen, I predominantly know from The West Wing, his television career, in which he is President Dad. And also I saw a gif of him today from...
My evidence for wanting him was my dad. I saw this gif.
Which I think, I'm assuming, is from one of the Hot Shots movies, where Charlie Sheen, the main character, is on a boat, and there's a boat coming in the distance. And it's as it comes closer, it's Martin Sheen dressed as like his character from Apocalypse Now, going down the river, and they just point at each other and say at the same time, I loved you in Wall Street. And point fingers. And both keep going. And it's like, Charlie Sheen's obviously gone off the rocks a little bit. Martin Sheen, famous alcoholic, and I've seen the bloopers from his Apocalypse Now performance where he punches a mirror and cuts his hand open because he's so drunk. But, yeah.
Still
I go with that as a dad. More than guy who beats up Iron Man. That's not cool.
Is that your evidence against Jeff Bridges? He beat up Iron Man.
See, I'm going for Jeff Bridges. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that I have more experience of Martin Sheen in the sense that I played a lot of Mass Effect. And he is your space dad.
Oh, yeah. He's the elusive man. He's not necessarily the one you
the
want.
The absentee dad. Like.
The elusive dad. Yeah. If you've played Mass Effect, Graham, you are answering very different.
The other reason, I was talking to somebody about this today, actually, and this is a coincidence that we got this question, but Jeff Bridges, over time, has sublimated into becoming a creature of basically barking and growls. I mean, he's still a good actor, he's still an entertaining performer, But, you know, fundamentally, his output could be expressed as, like, rumbling noises, you know? Like, and there's something, I think, phenomenally canine about the man. And it might say something about me that in selecting the actor I'd rather have as my dad, I picked the one that I can think of more as just a gigantic dog. But that's definitely Jeff Bridges.
If a dog was an option, would you go for the dog rather than...
Which one, yeah, which one would I rather have as a dog? Jeff Bridges.
No,
which...
I meant a dog as a father. That was the third
dog, Mark Sheen, or Jeff Bridges.
No, just a dog. I'm just doing a regular dog. Option number three is just a regular dog is now your dad.
See, that doesn't tell me anything about the dog. Whereas I feel like I already know what kind of dog... Jeff Bridges is.
You have more of an idea of what Jeff Bridges would be as a dog than as a general.
And that maybe tells you a lot about my relationship with my own father. But like the...
Which Jeff Bridges would you go for though? Like if you could pick one of his roles, would it be Tron or creepy CG Jeff Bridges from Tron? Or would it be the dude?
Yeah, no, I don't think it'd be the dude, although I think my actual dad went through that phase. I think it would be Iron Man era Jeff Bridges, actually.
And is the Jeff evil Bridges one?
That beat up Iron Man?
No, because he's... Yes, he makes some bad decisions, but he does show up with pizza. He gets on a private plane and delivers pizza from New York. That's pretty rad. Two, that is one of his most sounding like a dog the entire movie performances. There's the Mark Kermode review of Iron Man is really good for that, for pointing out that entire movie is basically just happens at a series of registers, and one of the most important registers is Jeff Bridges going for basically the entire film,
especially like the last 20 minutes when he's just inside a CG robot.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know. Also, actually, in the comics, Obadiah Stane's kid turns out to be cool briefly before he melts. So, I would totally go for Iron Man era Jeff Bridges to be my dad for some reason.
Can I choose the guy from Terriers who looks like Jeff Bridges but isn't?
Well, he's cool.
Yeah.
Everyone should watch Terriers. This is a great excuse to put Terriers in the show notes.
If I can't have him, then Martin Sheen.
Good. Jake McKenzie writes, you talk about game series all the time that are uniquely British. What are some games that come off as uniquely American?
Ah, that's a tough one. games that seem American.
In their outlook, political sensibility, accents of the main characters.
Yeah, I'm covering all the angles. I just can't see it. I mean, they'd have to have shooting in them, for one. And then they'd have to, like jingoistic patriotism and sort of a gross simplification of international politics.
American voice actors, American settings.
That'd be really macho and stuff. I just can't think of any video games that would match that.
It'd be commercialistic.
They'd have
pioneering through violence.
They'd have to valorize military activity to the point where what military activity even was became a kind of nonsense. Just sort of boiling down almost any kind of action scenario you can think of as if it was some kind of honorable response to social demand.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. Yeah, it's just a different world to our own.
Someone answering the
summons of responsibility.
Yeah, the mandate of a democratic but nonetheless military society. I don't know what you would even call
the army.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what you'd even call that.
I suppose
home front. Adam writes, why are LGBT people so much better at MOBAs than the rest of us? He is referring, we should stress before someone gets really upset. He is referring to a would be hilarious if it wasn't also sad if it wasn't also hilarious decision by an esports organization that I can't remember the name of, therefore won't risk slandering.
This lack of memory is really useful in keeping legally responsible.
Who have decided for their all-female League of Legends tournament, which is a flawed concept in and of itself. Although
it's a potentially good idea.
It's got pros and cons.
Yeah,
got pros and cons. Yeah. Like there are arguments being made that obviously you can encourage more women to play esports by having female only tournaments. However, you also perpetuate the notion that players should be sequestered at all in esports, which they obviously shouldn't, were things otherwise equal. So it's tricky. It's a tricky situation, admittedly. However, they've now established some rules, apparently after some deliberation, that teams Mayfield over the course of a tournament, and this is their words. I stress their words. Their words.
I'm laughing because I know what's coming.
They Mayfield one gay or one transsexual woman.
For some reason, using the word "gay" in that context, yeah, is
just
now
gay
is
a noun. As soon as you do that, you've gone in deep into the wrong territory.
Gay, okay.
they use it as an example. Like they throughout the whole thing, they're talking about like a gay / transgendered person, which is the wrong way to refer to them. But then they're saying, like, so for example, you could have a team of four women and one gay.
and they also stress that you must have, should you wish to field a gay twice, you must use the same gay.
you may not select a fresh gay.
Yeah.
Is all the people on Twitter mocking this do the thing that sometimes comes up in legal language where they write the word one, as in O-N-E, and then in brackets after it put the numeral one. Yeah. So exactly. One.
Yeah, gay. A single gay. Singular instance of a gay.
Is that true in the actual document?
I don't know,
is that
I hope
only
it is.
In the parody?
Because I do that as well. That. it's so fucking stupid, but it's also so offensive. Jesus. Like, they basically...
I haven't seen any outrage about it, is the thing. I've only seen jokes so far. Like, just people taking the piss out of it because it's almost so ridiculous. It's almost like crossed the threshold.
I think it's because
like,
you've kind of like tripped over yourself and landed in the custard pie at that point, because you've attempted to hold a tournament for women.
Mm.
On the surface, perhaps laudable goal, albeit with some questions to be raised about the running and what it means and what you're stressing. Because there's a history in esports of running women's tournaments that are so advertised to men, like see hot ladies play Dota. You know, it's creepy, even if it's, you know, and it's not a victory for inclusivity because it's weird, right? That's a valid objection to raise. If in good faith they wanted to run this thing and they genuinely wanted to bring more women in the business, they have absolutely fucked it up. the moment they start to enter into what I presume has to be a decision based on the idea that, and this is into fucking bizarro gender politics at this point, but the notion that a homosexual male, or identifies as male, would qualify as a woman at all for the purposes of a female only tournament.
Mm.
At that point, you're defining gender more based on sexuality.
Yeah.
Is that what they're saying?
But by, really? Well, by including... But
when they say gays, gay, don't they mean, surely, lesbian?
I don't know, do they?
That's what, that was my assumption. Oh, but it's still baffling, because it doesn't make any
sense. It doesn't make any sense.
So if you want to try and pass it, my only way of passing it was like, if you had a really aggressive attitude towards transgender people, then maybe you think, okay, transgender women aren't really women, they're actually secretly men, they're men in disguise, that's how you're LGBT.
Then you're saying that
obviously that's a terrible attitude to have, but if you had that attitude and you thought also men were superior to women at esports, then you could say, okay, they're using their secret men powers in their disguise as a woman.
See, the way I interpreted it is that it ended up at this viewpoint where the only the thing they wanted to be consistent across the team was an enjoyment of dicks. and so that would be the unifying factor, which implies a universe where the real, you know, the thing that qualifies most esports athletes to be esports athletes is their disdain for cocks. And these people are held back by their unfortunate.
What makes
affection.
Us so powerful is our disdain for cocks.
Yeah, exactly. And what makes these people so, you know, they require their own bracket. It is like they. Rather than, I mean, what it comes down to, I guess, is rather than do any kind of real learning about the issues that they might confront, they might be faced with in running their tournament, they have attempted to invent their own identity politics from scratch and have fucked that up about as much as you would expect someone who has decided to, like, go, what is gender, really?
Let's make a list.
For the sake of this tournament, women can be defined as... you know, people who are born with female genitalia, transgender women, and gays for some reason. Good for us. Problem solved, everyone. Let's publish that policy for other people to see.
Yeah, it does speak to a certain naivety that they didn't realize it.
It does. It is. I think that's the only reason why it's funny and not desperately sad, and it's kind of both, is because the fact that they haven't hidden it is so naive that it is that kind of, like, fucking Labrador at a computer. Like, I have no idea what I'm doing, kind of.
It speaks to a certain kind of progress, I think. People are, at least according to my Twitter feed, which is not necessarily a relative sample of, you know, but I think it speaks to progress that people are finding this hilarious more than they are necessarily outrageous.
Yeah. It's so funny. It's somehow less enraging.
Yeah. You can't take it seriously. Oh, these people are just idiots.
Yeah, it's like those cats that are like Hitler. You know?
Yeah.
It's like
Hitler was bad. That's Hitler a funny was cat.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, boy. Someone needs to fix that problem. John writes, do you think cross-platform multiplayer will ever catch on? Valve dropped it in CSGO, but MS is pushing it with Windows 10 games.
I've never been excited about it, even. So I was at E3 in 2005, 10 years ago, where Microsoft was like, cross-platform, this is going to be amazing. We're going to have Xbox people playing with Windows people. And they kind of did with Shadowrun, and it didn't work that well. But even if it had, what do I care what they're playing on? I mean, I want people to play with. If there's no one to play with, then for sure open it up and make sure there's more people to play with. But I don't really care what input device they're using.
Yeah, I don't I mean, maybe it's different for people in the real world, but I don't have a lot of people who... I'm a PC gamer, but lots of my friends are Xbox gamers, and so I don't get to play with them. That's not a situation that comes up, and I don't really care that their numbers go from 10,000 players to 100,000 players or whatever, because there's cross-platform play. But also, I don't think it's ever going to take off for, well, games like CSGO. I don't think it's ever going to take off for first-person shooters, because a controller, however good it might be for certain kinds of first-person shooters, or all first-person shooters, is never going to be equal to keyboard and mouse.
There's literally a numerical limit on how fast you can turn.
Yeah.
That's just a hard fact. You can't get away from it.
Those are two things you should split off into two separate esports tournaments. Whereas, well, I mean, you talked about in Fenny Factory earlier, and it pops up whenever you complete a level to say how efficiently you did it versus how efficiently someone else did it. Like, those kind of time-insensitive games might be, sure, the fact that someone else has played it on an Xbox, and whereas I played it on a PC, great, whatever. But the kind of most positive response you can have to cross-platform play is whatever.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
like, that's the kind of definition of it is, it doesn't matter. Woo!
If you've done it, okay, I guess.
Yeah. Yep.
It totally depends on the game. Like, you know, Hearthstone is a natural fit for it. A game I've been playing a bunch on my iPad, as we talked about in a previous episode. Where I'm playing against people on the PC, because it doesn't make a fucking difference, because it's just dragging cards. And the fact that I might be naked at the time makes it bearing regardless of what platform I'm using, you know?
Yep.
Basically, do you need a mouse to do it? If so, don't. If not, probably.
That's why it's not particularly exciting that SOE are now Daybreak game company, and therefore can release multi-platform games. Because they're either going to, you know, and they make a point in the press release.
All right, something you just said triggered Siri in the other part of the room. Go away, Siri.
Siri, what is Daybreak Game Company?
You have to say, hey, Siri.
Hey, Siri.
Fuck you, Graham. Jesus. Siri's not available.
That doesn't pick up on the mic. Shiver. Siri not available.
You must have, SOE must have sounded like Siri.
Yeah. Huh. Hey, SOE.
That's why they changed it.
No, it didn't work.
Yeah, they make a point in the press release of saying that they can now release games on other platforms, including mobile. What games do SOE have that you want to play on your iPad, Siri?
Answer me that, Siri.
Huh? Hey, Siri, do you want to play PlanetSide 2 on a mobile phone?
Didn't work.
It was a joke that went nowhere.
My phone would respond, but I disabled
they,
Siri.
They did run like a trading card game for Star Wars Galaxies, famously. Massively popular.
I don't know why that's so funny. Did they redesign it shortly after launch?
And hey, fuck you. Don't go there. I actually wrote something about SWE this morning.
Of course you did.
Every day. Never forget. It's all I could do that one time I attended SOE Live, not to run on stage during their keynote, tear off my shirt to reveal the Star Wars Galaxies tattoo across my chest, and then just weep openly.
Well, everyone cheered in solidarity.
Yeah.
Oh, I was a blacksmith, god damn it. I didn't want to be a Jedi.
I made chess! What a game. Possibly the best game. We'll never know. What were we talking about?
Questions. Another question.
With a tattoo like that, Polygon would write an article about you.
Oh, we're going to that phase of the evening.
Oh, snap.
Only if you hadn't yet got it.
Andrew Duncan writes, Dear Tiberian Sons, my question is regarding the most pressing news of the week, the World of Warcraft selfie camera. I can only assume that you've already covered this in some depth. I'm writing just in case. Personally, I'm amazed that selfies still carry weight as a cultural phenomenon. I'm not amazed that people still take them. I'm just amazed that people can still be excited about the idea of them. I mean, it's just a way of holding a camera. It's not even new. Just recently popularized. Does nobody remember the profile pictures that people used to have on MySpace? But I digress. Will this be the feature that makes you resubscribe to WoW? Will it reinvigorate WoW, or possibly the entire MMO genre? Do any of you own selfie sticks? Actually, I think this technology has been put to use in the wrong game. If in Just Cause 3 your photo was automatically taken every time you jump from a cliff while something is exploding, then that would at least 2 points to the score. Similarly, they could reimagine Max Payne as a kind of scored stunt game where you need to dive between two guys, shoot them both in the head, then turn, take a sick selfie, and have it uploaded to Facebook before the bullets impact. Are there any other games that could be saved by the addition of selfies? Tanks Fought Christmas, quoting Trotsky.
Wow. Max Payne could have, like, dual-wielding selfie sticks, two different angles of himself at the same time.
Totally diving sideways.
I read the announcement that WoW had a selfie stick with a sort of mixture of, well, like a sort of rollercoaster of emotions, the first of which was disgust and like, oh god, are they really just, does it just have to be fucking everything now? Does it just have to be, oh, it's a word, so we just got to put it in fucking everything. And then thinking, no, actually, I would quite like to take a photo of my character in various locations. It seems perfectly fine that you can do that, and it's quite a cool feature to add, so well done. It's just the word. I don't know what, like, just the word is, it does something weird to people. Because that was a thing, as he says, that's the thing we did before. We already did it all the time. And then someone invented a word for it, and suddenly just everyone can't fucking shut up about it. They've got to say the word all the time. Anytime there's a photo, even if it's not taken by the person who's in the photo.
Yeah,
that's a selfie now.
Fucking news reporters posting pictures of the dogs on Twitter and describing it as a selfie. Your dog was not holding the camera.
Yeah, I think I really want Elite Dangerous to get a selfie camera. I actually wanted this for a while. I don't know who I was moaning in real life. Look, this isn't real life. about this. I want a module you can fit to a ship that allows you to launch a camera that you can control separately to give you an in-universe way of taking screenshots of the outside of your ship.
Mm.
Like Outer Wilds.
Yeah. Yeah, like Outer Wilds, but it would be like a full HD kind of, you know.
Do you know, does your character model have a head?
No, it doesn't. If you can find that out if you're wearing Oculus Rift. Because if you're wearing a DK2.
I've done that with a DK2 actually, but I don't remember.
So if you step out of your pilot seat while you're wearing a DK2, it knows enough about your positioning to move you out of the pilot seat. So you get the sense that you've sat up from the chair and moved elsewhere in the cockpit. But if you look back, your body is still on the chair, but it doesn't have a head.
And that's a science fiction film.
Yeah. Yeah. Submitted for your approval. We should move on. Dennis Ryan asks, Dear Wraith and Crowbar, last episode you discussed the merits of Diablo 3 and Path of Exile, well, Tom Senior did, and somehow failed to mention PoE's greatest strength, necromancy. Where Diablo only allows you to summon a paltry handful of creatures, PoE allows you to summon a host of zombies, ghouls, skeletons, and other horrors. Ordinarily, I dislike the Diablo-like genre, but the meaty necromancy skills were enough to make me thoroughly enjoy playing the game, even if my build wouldn't have been viable at high difficulties. Have any of you ever enjoyed a game only or mainly because it featured one style of play that you really appreciated? Or, sorry, that really appealed to you? Is there any fantasy that, given the option, you will always pursue in an open world or open-ended game, whether that's being a garbage man or a pirate? Cheers, Dennis.
Archer. Far Cry 3 and Far Cry 4, which are both not short games, I played entirely using the basic bow and arrow as my only weapon, pretty much.
It's really good in Tomb Raider, too. Sorry, in Tomb Raider, the recent remake. Also, yes. Tomb Raider 2 could mean several things.
I'll pretty much try and play any game I can stealthily. Not always no kill or anything like that, but just whatever the metric is for being stealthy in that game, I will do it. And certainly with it, whatever game has a bow and arrow in, that will just become the game to me. Even if it's TF2, which has 9 classes and dozens of weapons, as soon as they added a bow and arrow, well, this game's about being a guy with a bow and arrow now.
It's fucking great too. Like, I can't think of a game that has a bow and arrow where the bow and arrow isn't fucking awesome. Mm. I guess, like, I don't know, like, Skyrim was pretty good. Oblivion, it wasn't so good. And I think probably the further back in the Elder Scrolls series you go, the worse bows got. they used to be pretty ineffective. You just pelt people with hundreds and hundreds of arrows before you got anywhere. But actually, my answer to this question is necromancers. I played a necromancer in Diablo 2. And I decided I was going to be a necromancer even before it came out, because I was obsessed. I loved Diablo, and I was obsessed with everything I could consume about Diablo 2, all of the screenshots and news and stuff, and I knew, like, character builds even before the game was out. I was like, this is the first skill I'm going to get. I'm going to put 3 points in that, then I'm going to upgrade to Bone Spear, and then I'm going to get this and this and this. And then when I played it, I actually found Necromancer really difficult, because if you don't know the game, even though it's pretty similar to Diablo, I was just failing all the time. I was just very weak. And so I went back to Barbarian, and I played, like, I would just storm through the whole thing as Barbarian and completed the whole game. And then only once I understood the game was I good enough to go back and actually play Necromancer and play the class that I really wanted to be. And it was, like, it's still quite tricky at first, but then you get to a certain critical mass with the Necromancer in Diablo 2 where pretty much once we have Corpse Explosion, that's when it gets amazing. Because Corpse Explosion is, after you've killed something, you can blow up its corpse, and the amount of damage that that explosion does to the surrounding enemies is proportional to the number of hit points that thing had when it died. So you can kill a weak thing, blow it up, does a little bit of damage, softens up all the other people, then you take them down, and they were tougher things. So then when you blow up their corpses, that does more damage to the remaining people, who are also quite damaged from the first thing. And then eventually you take down, like, the toughest thing in the whole mob, and then you blow up that thing's corpse, and that takes down fucking everything. And that creates a whole load of corpses, and then you can blow up all the corpses. Like, no matter what's left, it just created this, like, tide. There was just, in every battle, I would... Once I was, like, level... I can't remember what the levels were in Diablo 2, but high level, towards the end of the game, I had a really good dagger that was... I think it was called, like, Pentadax Screaming Cinquitega of Blood. Some weird, like... I can't remember the name of the actual, like, dagger was. And that meant it was... It would poison people... I think that was the off blood thing of making them bleed for like a massive amount of damage for over a very long period of time. But the screaming part meant that they were terrified when they're hit by it. So every time I stabbed someone, they ran away from me, no matter how scary they were. And then I would stab anyone who got near me. They would run away whilst bleeding to death. And then all of my minion skeletons would be hacking away at everybody and just causing like attrition damage. And then at some point, somebody would die. And as soon as the first person died, Corpse Explosion, and I think by then I'd upgraded to Poison Explosion, which also creates a cloud of poison gas that then does damage over time, and then that would create more corpses, and basically no matter how big, no matter how tough the mob is, in fact, the bigger and the tougher the mob is, the more dramatic the explosion is when the first corpse goes down, and then the more you hit this critical mass where just everything can die. And unfortunately, Corpse Explosion has been kind of phased out of RPGs, because as things go more in a ragdoll direction... Ragdoll is always, because it's a physics calculation, it's something that kind of has to happen on the client side, which means each individual computer of all the people who are playing the game calculate it locally, which means corpses fall in different places for different players, which means you can't have a corpse explosion spell, because where the explosion happens is super gameplay critical, and so they just end up removing corpse explosion when they have something slightly different. So you don't really see it much in games anymore.
No, it's getting Tragic in a really weird, nerdy way.
I like to go really fast in computer games, and I'll always pick the playstyle that allows me to go really fast. Not just like speed through the game, but acrobatic or aerial or...
double jump for the win.
Yeah. In all those lines. Thomas Westergaard writes, "Deer, crow and caterpillar. You spelt deer like deer the animal. A joke that would not be very obvious unless I did explain that, thus making it not ideal." As a read out thing. "I like systems in video games, especially when players break them. In Red Alert 2, as the Soviets, you can build cloning vats that produce one soldier when your barracks do. By creating a wall around your barracks, the units are not created and are therefore refunded, but a unit is still created by the cloning vat, effectively giving you free units." This bug was later fixed in a patch. "Another favourite of mine is in Europa, this is really hard to say after the amount of rum I've had, Europa Universalis 4, you can at one point increase the tariffs on your colonies beyond 100%, then subsidising them with large amounts, giving you infinite money. Do you gents have a favourite exploit, and what is it? Greetings from Thomas in Denmark." Mm.
I have never tried this myself, but if you look up Morrowind speedrun, you will find someone who's completed Morrowind in like 7 minutes, or it's probably like 6 minutes or 5 minutes by now. Because Morrowind is an open world game, it's an Elder Scrolls game, like Skyrim and Oblivion. And a lot like those games, there's things like alchemy and enchantment and stuff. And I can't remember the exact precise details of how this works, but the trick is basically you go to the nearest like mage's guild, and then you get from them a potion of enchantment that increases your enchanting ability. And then you drink that, and you use that increased enchanting ability to enchant an amulet to give you increased alchemy. And then you wear the amulet of increased alchemy to make a new potion of increased enchantment. And then you drink the potion of increased enchantment. And then you make a new use the enchantment to make a better alchemy ring. And then you use the better alchemy ring to make a better enchantment ring. And then like a sort of snowballing, repeating cycle of improving both those skills. Then eventually you just make some potions that, or some rings or something that just give you like massive strength and massive health, and then you just run straight to the end boss and just punch him in the face and kill him and just win the whole game. Oh, and also you use, that's the exploit, but the other thing that makes it work is there's, a little story quest right near the start of the game that, you're walking along a road and a mage just falls out of the sky screaming, slams into the ground and dies. And if you search his body, he has a diary on him that explains what he's doing, and two or three scrolls of Icarian flight, and they're scrolls that increase your jumping power by 10,000% for like 2 seconds. So you cast it, and then you jump, and you can literally jump across the entire game world. You just soar into the world. And the only thing that, the only problem with it is, like, the way it works is it increases your agility. Agility increases your jumping height and your resistance to fall damage. But, because it only lasts 2 seconds, if you cast one and then jump, by the time you land, it would have worn off and you'll die from the fall. Hmm. So you need one to jump and then you need to cast the other one just before you land so that you have enough agility to survive the fall. And he does that and lands exactly outside the main boss's lair and then walks in, like, I think he has like a battle axe or something, and he just uses like his 10,000 strength from his infinite potions to destroy him. And it's so like, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, it's technically an exploit, but there's nothing about the systems that suggests that it's sort of not intended. It's just clever. It's just, you are smart, and you use the systems well, and so you win. Well done.
I think for this one, I'd go to the Dota place, briefly. Because the interesting thing about a game like Dota, where it comes to exploits, is... unlike in a different type of game, an exploit is often something that's kind of defined if it's removed. So if someone finds a strategy that is subsequently removed entirely by the developer, then it was an exploit. There are no current exploits in Dota. There are only retroactive exploits.
We've always been at war with Eurasia.
We have always been at war with Eurasia. However, fountain hooking was broken. And like, fountain hooking is the one I was going to bring up, because it was such a... it was originally like a dumb pub game trick. So there's a character called Chen who has an ability which, if you cast it on an ally, after a couple of seconds of delay, teleports that ally back to the fountain. So basically it's like a send home ability. Like, you're wounded, I'm going to send you home to heal up in the fountain. And then this Pudge, who's a really famous Dota character, throws a hook that drags people towards him. The way Pudge's hook was programmed at the time meant that when the way it worked is Pudge threw out a projectile, the hook connected with an enemy, and then the enemy was dragged to Pudge's position.
I see where this is going.
So what you could do was cast Chen's Test of Faith recoil ability on Pudge and then throw the hook. And if the hook connected as Pudge teleported back to the fountain, the hook would then extend to an infinite length, as long as it needed to be, to drag whoever it was back into what was for them the enemy fountain. And fountains are designed to repel, they're supposed to be a safe area, they're designed to repel enemies. So that was basically a death sentence. Wherever you were on the map, whatever happened, you would just fly across the entire map. And you see, it wouldn't render the hook itself, because the hook would just be drawn between Pudge at the point of casting and the hero that was caught. But that hero would then enter every hero has an animation for being, like, pushed or dragged against their will, which is not like a flailing kind of thing. And they would just fly across the map, like it's a kind of like nightmarish Twilight Zone scenario where gravity is now sideways. Like, they would just be falling down the map towards the enemy fountain where they'd be completely annihilated. And it was only removed when Na'Vi used it against Tong Fu in some point during the stage games of the International 3.
Uh-huh.
It was actually used in Pro Match. And it won that Pro Match because it became this thing that they just didn't know how to deal with. It was like they prepared for pro play, not for, like, fucking just randomly losing a guy to gravity every now and then because of, like, magical hooks. But I still really liked it in a way because it was like, it made complete sense as a combination of game mechanics. What they eventually did is they changed it so that Pudge's hook returned you, dragged you to where Pudge was when they cast the hook.
Yeah.
So it didn't relocate. If Pudge moved, you didn't. Which fixed it, pretty much. But at the same time, it was like something kind of magical about the nonsense of Dota had been lost, and it was really hard to do. Like, you had to time things perfectly for it to match up right, and you know, to land the hook at the exact moment that the Chen spell sent you back. Like, it's hard, but it was also bullshit, so possibly good riddance. One last question for the evening. Nick writes, "Dear CNC Music Factory, I was listening to your debate on possible games analysis courses with interest yesterday, as I've just spent the weekend writing a proposal for a postdoctoral research project that basically amounts to please pay me to research games based on real places for 3 years, as they're really interesting." While you will not find a games analysis course out there in the same way, you might find an art history course or a film studies course, academics in the cultural studies field are getting their teeth into games. That sentence didn't make any sense, but I'm going to go anyway. Often this simply takes the tools of the film or text analysis and applies it to games, which I think misses the uniqueness of games, particularly their link to real spaces. People can visit places and see places that they've seen before in paintings and film, but game players travel to find themselves sneezing in places they have been before. Games offer mental maps and a sense of knowing and negotiating a space for yourself that other media cannot. As a question then, have you ever been to visit somewhere that you've been to in a game, and what are the most interesting game worlds that are influenced by, if not exactly based upon, real-world places? He goes on to explain that his game, if he was asked to kind of teach a game, Graham's going to sneeze, it would be Stalker, but we'll go with the question, which is, have you ever been to a place that you've been to in a game, and are you going to sneeze?
Yes, to one of the questions. The first time I went to Liberty Island, I took with me my laptop and played Deus Ex on it and played Liberty Island bits. So I sat in, like, when you arrive in Deus Ex, I knew Liberty Island was a real place. I just assumed it was radically different to how it is in Deus Ex. I don't know why, but I kind of figured it was just like a statue that's in the water somewhere. But no, Liberty Island is pretty much as it is in Deus Ex. There's always terrorists walking around. You got to kill them all. I did my best, you know. but like, just the dock you arrive in on and the ferry is the same shape as the dock in Deus Ex that you arrive in on your secret agent boat. And the way you approach the statue, you're coming from the exact same angle, and the base is the same size as it is in Deus Ex. I didn't really expect it to be actually accurate. And so it's a really weird feeling to actually, I guess it only probably applies to games that you're obsessed with. You know, I've played Deus Ex probably 50 times, you know, to a substantive playthrough. And so that intro I played at least 50 times. And I just, like, I have lived that place. I've been there so many times. I know it intimately. I know what happens if you go down the steps into the water and break open the crate. I know what's in that crate. I know what Paul says to you, no matter which dialogue option you choose. I know where the bot comes from and all that stuff. And so seeing, like, the physical aspects of that mirrored in real life, but then, like, the game aspect of it obviously not being there, it was just very strange. It's like, I just inhabited New York as a fictional place until then. And I've been to New York before, but I've never been to Liberty Island.
I actually had a similar experience when I first went to Liberty Island, which I didn't play. I didn't get out my laptop and play Deus Ex there, but I had the same moment when I realised that the dock was the same shape.
Yeah.
Which was sort of like, this shouldn't be necessarily. Like, they should try harder to differentiate Deus Ex. I guess, like, there's a lot of places I've been to in America, you know, maybe related to the American games question from earlier, but I think I probably visited the place first. Like, I played GTA 4 after having been to Brooklyn for the first time, and it starts you off in Broco, which is its version of Brooklyn, and I had that kind of really powerful sense of place, the really sort of powerful sense of nostalgia. One of the ones I would go for is, I can't remember which Tomb Raider game it is, but one of them has Lara Croft exploring the ruins in Cambodia, like Cambodian temples. I think it's fairly non-specific. I'm actually really failing to locate which exact Tomb Raider game it is. It might be 2, it might be 3. It's in that middle period of Tomb Raider generally. But I went to Angkor in Cambodia, having played this game when I was about 18, and one thing that really struck me about those temples is, like, how small and relatively flat they were. And not that I was necessarily expecting, like, gigantic, colossal ancient machinery, like sluice gates and doors that open because you stood on pressure plates or whatever. But I think, that's such a dumb thing to say, but, like, those games did genuinely set up pretty severe false expectations for what ancient architects were capable of building. And they're not the first by any means. So, you know, they follow on from a tradition from, like, matinee fiction in general towards imbuing ancient architecture, particularly with the power of being whatever the fuck it needs to be in order to furnish a boulder rolling down a corridor.
Yeah, particularly mysterious and kind of puzzling or demanding.
Yeah.
Was the real thing disappointing, Mike Brassen?
Not really, but it was like, I realized, the moment I got there, I was like, not that I was like, it's not so fucking dumb, but like, it was like, just recalibrate your expectations around what's actually practical. Like, and not just recalibrate your expectations of what's impressive. You know, yeah. Like, games really teach you to expect that ancient people are capable of some fucking phenomenal things.
Actually, they weren't that good.
They weren't that good.
Very primitive. They didn't have bulldozers and shit.
Yeah, they didn't have bulldozers. They didn't have logic switches, you know, like.
Sure, there was a pyramid, but there was a giant boulder chased after me.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess for me, I mean, it's New York again. Grand Theft Auto 4 is the kind of key example. There have been a ton of instances, but Star Junction in Grand Theft Auto 4 is Times Square in real life, and when I first went to New York, which was only a little over a year ago, because I went for Christmas, I stayed pretty much on Times Square, and a lot of my experiences of it, aside from being, I've seen this in movies, and this a lot of adverts. It was, this is a lot like Star Junction is in GTA 4. And a lot of the rest of New York as I explored it was, you sort of, like, recognize bits of architecture, but not necessarily street layouts, whereas, because of the nature of Times Square, it is pretty much exactly the angle of the streets as you pull away from that is the same as Star Junction in Grand Theft Auto. and it was certainly played on my mind a lot. I don't know, it didn't necessarily give me any greater insight or anything more than that, but certainly whenever I would come out of my hotel to walk over to the pharmacy to buy crisps, I would be like, yeah, it's a lot like playing Grand Theft Auto 4 in first person right now, as I stared up at the objects.
I did have, once I had it the other way around, where I was watching, before Grand Theft Auto 5 came out, I watched Tom Bramwell of Eurogamer playing it. He just did like a Let's Play thing on YouTube, and so it was my first experience of Grand Theft Auto 5, and he was just driving around Los Angeles, basically, and I've been to Los Angeles many times on various press trips and stuff, some of them with Tom, I think, and I realised I was recognising streets. I was like, I know which street this is. I know if he goes left right there, he's going to be on Santa Monica Beach, and if he goes a bit further, there's going to be a gym with a bunch of like muscle freaks there, and then if you go out further out towards the sea on sand, there'll be a bunch of people like playing improv music and stuff. And yeah, it's all really accurate.
That is all of the questions we have time for today, and indeed all of the rest of the pod we have time for. If you'd like to send us a question, you can do so by emailing us at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet us at crateandcrowbar. You can leave a question on our forum, and there's a sub-forum dedicated to that, at crateandcrowbar.com/forum. Or, as a last resort, only to be used by the most desperate, you can follow us and tweet us as individuals. I am C. Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Tom is
P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T. That's Pentadact.
And Graham is
at Gunnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
Thanks for listening, everyone.